Hi, Who Shot You listeners? This is producer Casey here. I just wanted to say a quick word at the top of the show. Some of you may have noticed that you had some Switchblade Sisters episodes in your Who Shot You podcast feed. I just wanted to say that that was a complete mistake, and we are very sorry for that mix-up. We are transferring over where our podcasts live online, and the feeds got mixed up. And so we accidentally dropped a bunch of Switchblade Sisters into the Who Shot You feed. And for those of you who are not subscribed to Switchblade Sisters, that is a big annoyance, having to download a bunch of episodes that you did not want on your phone. So we are very sorry about that. I know that caused some major problems for people, so we're very sorry. And we're completely switched over, so it won't happen again. But I just wanted to say a quick word about that at the top of the show, that that is not something that will happen again, and that is not something normal. That was just a mistake that we, and more specifically, I made. So anyways, on with the show.
Careful, man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi. On the day we're recording this, it is Ify Nwadaway's birthday. So not with us because he's off being excellent somewhere else, but happy birthday,
happy
Ify.
Happy birthday, Ify.
Thirst King.
Indeed. Oh, my. Anyway, let's get started, shall we? That was, of course, a freelance writer whose work you can read in The Hollywood Reporter, Teen Vogue, and The AV Club, and now a producer at iHeartMedia, Joelle Monique.
Pew, pew, pew.
Joelle, what's good?
What is good? I have a new job, and it's excellent.
Nice.
Yeah, very much looking forward to not being poor. Gonna really change my life, so woo,
oh,
money!
Fun.
Yes.
How droll.
Listen, I'm catching up with everybody else.
It's
this
the 21st century
thing.
Dream.
It really is. Oh, how exciting. I'm getting a paycheck, not to brag.
It's going
to
be on health insurance? What?
Oh, health insurance.
Listen, it's got everything. Oh, amazing.
Queen.
Definitely. That is worth the self air horns you started that.
Yeah, no kidding. Dag. Also, of course, with us, producer and film festival programmer, Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
So I have a roundabout what's good, but it does give me such joy.
Right, get us there.
So 7 years ago, in March of 2013, March, April 2013, I was working on the LA Film Festival based at Film Independent. And for one of those like morale boosting team things, we were like, or they set up so that all the different departments did a guacamole competition.
Yes.
Oh. And so like we teamed up and so I put together a little squad with the women that were all sitting in my section. So it was me and some other people from programming, a few people from ticketing. And so we put together our team and whatever, and then we thought it would be really funny to like, oh, let's like make a brand of it. So we made a Facebook page for ourselves.
Oh my god,
it was so ridiculous. And then like we decorated our table. Friends, of course, we won said guacamole competition.
So
it was very exciting. I did not make any of the guacamole. The funniest part, and what's good with me, is 7 years ago we made this Facebook page, and what we called it was the Red Tent Collective, because that was like a very funny nod to, we were the only group that was all women, and we're like, yes, and we all sat in the same room, which we referred to as the Red Tent.
Oh no.
That book was very big. And to this day, it gets likes by total strangers on Facebook.
Oh my goodness.
That must not be looking at any of it, because none of us have posted anything for six some years, and it is just a few random pictures and posts about women at an office making guacamole.
Oh,
and every
God.
Time I turn on my Facebook and I see the Red Tent Collective has two new likes, I'm like, thank you, people out there. Thank you for your optimism and your assumptions about what this collective could possibly be.
This is so wholesome. And when will you guys start wholesaling your guacamole? Because
right?
I mean,
yeah, that's the thing.
Clearly
I really need
there's
to
an interest.
Monetize
bring
this.
That social media ghost account back to life.
Yes, we'll look into it. Alonzo, what's good with you?
Oh, I'll tell you what's good with me. My friend Margie is a professional writer and is always telling me very good professional writer tips. And she pointed me to a website called Otter, OTTER.
Yes!
I don't think it's not otter.com, it's otter.something else, but Google it, you'll find it.
Ugh.
Otter allows you to drag audio files into it, and it will turn it into text.
Pew, pew, pew.
No.
Now, I mean, like, it's not 100% perfect.
No, no.
You still have to go back and listen to things and sort of fix stuff, and it doesn't always quite, you know, hear what they're saying. But oh my God, as somebody who is currently having to go through and transcribe 100 plus episodes of a certain podcast I'm writing a book about, this is saving my life.
Oh my God, that's great.
I had an hour long interview with a star that I was very excited about, but the idea of transcribing it was the most daunting thing. I hate transcribing. I'm terrible at it. You got to listen to your voice over and over again. It's tiresome. There is an app where you can, so Otter has an app. So if you're doing interviews, you can just record directly into the app and it will transcribe as you're talking into it.
Ooh.
Let me tell you, it changed my life.
Yeah, and like everything. The thing I'm doing, it's free. Like there are like,
oh, the app doesn't cost not one thing.
There are schmancier levels of Otter that get you other stuff, but like it is free.
The free one is just fine. I mean, yes. Maybe listen, Otter, if you want to send me your like exclusive like up thing and it's better, I'll tell the world. But for right now, what you're offering for free is really doing the trick.
Yes.
I have zero need for transcription services, but man, am I delighted on the behalf of both of you.
Listen, if you're the kind of person who likes to write books and maybe you orate, you know, your book instead of like typing, Otter, it's the source for you.
Listen, yeah. Alonzo, never tell me you don't orate to yourself. It's a vision I need to live with.
I have my moments of orating, but it's mainly just me at my typewriter like Meg Ryan and You've Got Mail looking very happy with myself and punching the sky.
I'll accept that as well.
Speaking of Meg Ryan, this is a retro rewind episode of Who Shot Ya. We are climbing into the Wayback Machine and going to 1990 to talk about Joe versus the Volcano. And we'll also have 1990 staff picks. It's going to be super exciting. But first, it's time for our news segment. Now, we are normally calling this It a Dick, which is short for Is This Important? Do I Care? But
no.
We're talking about the past, so we got to call
it
What a Dick.
What a dick.
Was this important? Do I care? Each of us will read a news segment about 1990 and answer the question, was this important? Do I care?
If I may interest you in a story, travel back with me, folks. On March 26th in 1990, the 62nd Academy Awards took place. It was hosted by Billy Crystal. Driving Miss Daisy won Best Picture, beating out Born on the 4th of July, Dead Poets Society, Field of Dreams, and My Left Foot. Do the Right Thing, famously not nominated for Best Picture. Some other winners include Daniel Day-Lewis, Danny Day-Lew, as I call him, for Best Actor for My Left Foot, Ms. Jessica Tandy, Best Actress for Driving Miss Daisy, Denzel Washington, Supporting Actor for Glory, and Brenda Fricker for Best Supporting Actress for My Left Foot. You guys, what a dick. Was this important? Do I care?
What a Dick is so right. It's important in that it is the one point of Oscar trivia history that I can always point to and go, wow, they really effed it up. Like, my God, so terrible. What were you thinking?
You mean the Do the Right Thing exclusion?
Not, first of all, if you haven't seen Driving Miss Daisy in a while, feel free to go back and experience that train wreck. Oh, Jessica Tandy is delightful in everything. Like, she can't do wrong. So it's not her fault. Morgan's doing what he's asked
Morgan,
to do.
It's her and Morgan Freeman, right?
Yeah.
I am sad to say I never saw it.
Listen, keep it out of your... Seen it before and you want to go back and revisit and be like, if it made you misty-eyed then and you're like, how do I feel about it in 2020? You feel a lot different. The beats are weird. It's shot kind of in a almost like white, blindingly like bright sort of way. It's not a great film. And then the exclusion of Do the Right Thing, it sort of probably will go where it happened in 2019, which is the lack of the Farewell nomination in Best Picture. It's just confounding. Like, how did this happen? Who let it happen? And why? I recently watched Do the Right Thing with a friend. Has Hector Navarro been on this podcast?
No.
No. Y'all should have Hector, first of all. Hector's done so many podcasts. If you're a friend of podcasts, you've probably heard his voice before. He's like a Batman expert. He works at DC. We watched that movie. It was his first time watching it, and his emotional journey was like a secondary watching for me. It was so beautiful. Do the Right Thing is everything. It should have been nominated. I don't know what happened.
The crazy thing is, the thing I remember about, there was a couple of years there where like all these indies or smaller movies that I liked would get screenplay nominations and then inevitably lose to like the big stupid movie. Mm-hmm. Like the following year, Ghost won original screenplay.
No,
over, oh yeah. Over, I got to get it in front of me, but like some real doozies. But this year, Dead Poets Society, which was fine, whatever. But
Captain, my Captain.
The greatest movie of all time? What?
Oh, honey. beat for best original screenplay, beat out Crimes and Misdemeanors, Do the Right Thing, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and When Harry Met Sally.
A boy killed himself. It was so sad. Listen, I watched that movie like at least 20 times in
Driving
school.
Driving Miss Daisy beat all those?
No. Dead Poets Society.
Dead Poets Society. Dur. That's how you led into that. Well, what's interesting to me is what stood out was those acting categories. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. If there's an actor, of course, who's playing a character based on a real life man, an artist with cerebral palsy. You have a very mature actress past the sort of sex appeal age, which women generally are only credited for. That Glory was a big stance in this, and Denzel won for that. And then Brenda Fricker, who I think is just such a fun, random left field choice for my left. So I was like, oh, the acting categories, that's pretty interesting. And now I'm like, oh, you guys are really bringing some raindrops into my sunshine.
Well, look, if you dig deeply enough into any Academy Awards, you'll find a few that, like, absolutely they got right. The best documentary winner at the 62nd Academy Awards was Common Threads from Epstein and Friedman about the AIDS names quilt.
Yes, yes.
Oh, wow. Such a good documentary.
An emotionally devastating documentary. Ooh. Like, still just rips my guts out. And features one of my literary heroes, Vito Russo. So, you know, like, there's always something in there you can dig up that they got right. I'll give them that one, if nothing
and
else.
And who isn't thrilled that Oliver Stone won Best Director? Who isn't?
Okay.
That movie was a very big deal in Dallas, where I was living at the time.
Born on the 4th of July?
Yes, because a lot of it shot there, and he was prepping JFK. So, like, you know, there was this whole, and I think he had shot Talk Radio there. Like, there was this Oliver Stone Dallas moment, you know. And so I remember living in the city, people were very excited about all that stuff.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to never watching Driving Miss Daisy.
There you go. Your life
there.
Will be okay.
That's the level of my
light
importance.
Awaits you.
It is important that I never see Driving Miss Daisy.
Also in the year 1990, the Motion Picture Association of America replaced the X rating with the NC-17 rating, which stands for No Children Under 17 Admitted. Prior to 1990, an X rating meant either not suitable for minors, or it could signify a non-trademarked film, which means you could get an X even without submitting it to the MPAA. As a result, porn films self-labeled themselves as X-rated films. The MPAA created the NC-17 rating in order to separate non-trademarked works from those rated as unsuitable for minors. The first film to receive an NC-17 rating was Philip Kaufman's Henry and June. Was this important? Do you care?
I care. I care about ratings a lot because I think it's an area that doesn't get a lot of daylight in discussion.
Sure.
And, you know, historically, you can look back and start with all the problems of the Hays Code and how it adjusts in. But one of the huge thing that factors in and how NC-17 directly reflects this is the ratings are super subjective, and to put something under the auspices of no children under 17, it says that there's like a baseline for how parents view materials for their kids. And yes. I think fundamentally that's screwed because everybody handles their family differently and every person or their kids can handle things differently. And the idea that there's just, and the other part of it, of course, is historically, things with sexual content are always graded on a higher curve than violence.
Yes.
And that is just so cooked into the rating system.
Yeah, if you've never seen Kirby Dick's documentary, this film is not yet rated.
Just gonna reference that.
I very highly recommend it. It's a shit show of a process. And I remember the excitement about NC-17 because Roger Ebert and a lot of other prominent critics would talk about filmmakers having to cut their stuff back to get an R rating, because if you didn't have an R rating, like, there were a lot of newspapers that wouldn't carry your ads. Certain theater chains wouldn't carry the film. And so NC-17 was going to be like, finally, the movies are going to grow up and we're going to have, like, we're going to allow this adult content. And almost immediately, it just became, it was X all over again.
Yeah.
Where movies
stood for the same thing.
Yeah. Theater chains wouldn't show them. Newspapers wouldn't advertise them. Films got cut to avoid an NC-17 rating. And so it defeated the whole purpose. But, you know, and then, and you had, like, early attempts to sort of, like, have a big crossover hit. And, like, after Showgirls tanked a couple of years after
Midnight Cowboy will always be the sort of interesting case study of what it was X-rated, and that not only did box office had cultural impact, but like swept the Oscars, like had all of these. But it is, it's that thing of how people view ratings, and then it, not just how they view it, but how it affects theatrical distribution, how it affects the marketing.
Oh, Blockbuster, who was enormous at the time, would not carry NC-17 films. They would carry unrated director's cuts or unrated European cuts. But if you actually had an NC-17 rating, you had to then also create an R rating that they could carry. So they had
an edit.
Yeah, they had like the R rated Henry and June and the R rated Poison and all these weird things. So it was, you know, the all the stupid stuff that made NC-17 necessary didn't go away in the face of NC-17.
Did Blockbuster didn't have the beaded curtain porno section then?
Oh no.
Okay.
No.
All right.
Wait, did they ever? You said then.
No,
Blockbuster introduced.
That was a local video store.
I was like, okay. I mean, our local store had the beaded section.
We got a Blockbuster like almost as they were closing. I lived in town. It was like 20,000 people, so I had it basically through high school. And by the time like freshman year of college, it was gone. So we had Family Video, and then there was another one. And I thought they both had beaded curtains, but it's so long ago in my memory. Who knows? What I find interesting about the NC-17 R-rating stuff is stuff I learned in that documentary, which is the idea that women aren't allowed to be sexual at the same rate as men and earn the same rating, which is why I think, like, it's frustrating to then see, like, you know, films from other countries where women are just allowed to be like, you know, like, oh, she masturbated. Okay. And it wasn't necessarily dirty. It's just an act that people do. And I'm with Drea on the whole rating situation being.
And don't even get me started about queer sexuality and
these
things. Much rougher on those. I mean, they gave a fucking PG-13 rating to Big Eden, which is the most innocuous movie ever. I mean, it's a good movie, but because it's queer.
The Rosie O'Donnell, like, am I? No.
What are you? You're talking about Exit to Eden. No.
No.
Wrong movie.
Oh my God, you're welcome for that vision.
Let's move on to something more exciting. Box office! Woo! The thing all of you really care about. These are the films that scored the best at the box office in March of 1990. Number one, The Hunt for Red October. Number two, Joe versus the Volcano. Three, Driving Miss Daisy. I'm disappointed in you, 90s. Four, Pretty Woman, a great film. Five, Hard to Kill, a movie I've never seen. Six, House Party, what a dope soundtrack. Seven, Madhouse, it is a madhouse. Eight was Bad Influence. Nine, Steel Magnolias, the best sick movie. And 10, Lord of the Flies. Guys, was this important and did you care?
I'm fascinated by Pretty Woman not being number one because
that
movie lasted forever.
Maybe it was just because it was March. Maybe it inched its way up.
Yeah, it opened in March. But like the thing is, like, I think now we're so used to like movies making all their money in the first two weekends.
That's true.
And I remember Pretty Woman was in theaters for like a year.
It's still in theaters. The thing that kills me about this, out of these 10 films, can you imagine having this many choices at your multiplex in a single weekend of like, and maybe it's just the veneer of looking back.
No.
I look at, what's currently playing? And I'm like, oh, there's two things I want to see.
Go back. If you want to be depressed, go back and look at the top three grossers of the last like 30 years. You will be amazed that like, not that long ago.
Oh, like per each year?
Yeah, for each year. Like the last 40 years. Like Terms of Endearment. Like these actual sort of grown-up dramas were like would be the top ranking, great, you know, like grossing film of the year. And now it's all like superhero IP and, you know,
listen,
whatever.
Hunt for Red October. What did dads do before that movie? You know, like,
what did TNT do before that movie?
How would our world change without that? Drive, you know, skipping as we've already stated, like Driving Miss Daisy.
Well, I think
I missed.
I mean, it was March of 90, and I'm sure the Oscars had just happened, so probably got a big bump from that.
That's a big thing too, of like how they release March now because it's structured differently.
Yeah.
People do such heavy campaigning, and so the films that are out in sort of like March is when they do start filtering through some decent films again. There's this dry spell in January, February, like right after award season, where they sort of bury the the dirty little films. Yeah, the stinkers.
It came out. We filled our contractual obligation.
Exactly.
I'm assuming Hard to Kill is a Steven Seagal.
It is. It's that period where all of his titles were Steven Seagal is blank.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Is Hard Up.
Exactly.
Yes, good.
Madhouse, is that like Kirstie Alley and John Larroquette or something?
Oh my God. I don't know, but what you, those words all together, I'm like, I can see a VHS copy, so it should be. I will say, Joelle is not wrong. Steel Magnolias does remain the best film to watch when you're sick. Shelby, drink your juice. I played Weeza in my high school production of Steel Magnolias.
I believe you've mentioned that.
Because I only ever played women in their 60s. As a teenager, which is very much my energy.
I always got sent into those kind of roles, too.
Yes.
Yes, you were right. Kirstie Alley and John Larroquette.
Oh, my God.
I did not see it. I do remember this Lord of the Flies. It was the one with Balthazar Getty.
Balthazar Getty, 100%.
Bad Influence was the was Rob Lowe and James Spader.
Like, the idea that Rob Lowe would make a film called Bad Influence, I don't know where this was.
Well, this was after the videotape incident.
Like,
this was the movie that was like, we are winking at the audience because you know that this thing happened and he's playing this sort of lechery person.
And they're like, put him next to Spader. He's going to look so clean
no,
cut.
And the cat Spader was like the innocent, you know, like the straight man for once.
God.
That was the shtick of that movie.
All right. Well, I know which one of these I want to see now for sure. Mm. Bad Influence. Sign me up.
Oh my God. I'm amazed that House Party was, I didn't know, House Party was introduced to me via VHS from my cousins, and so I always figured it was like this like underground
dance?
Low.
I taught myself the dance from the dance party sequence. I was like, get me in, and I learned both the girls that like start off the day and then theirs coming in. Oh yeah.
Listen, I watched it a lot. I'm not a dancer. I wish I was. I had aspirations to be a great dancer, but rhythm escaped me, and so It was a mess. At one point, I probably thought I was doing the dance. I was not. But I highly encourage the children to see it. Again, if you're under 20.
It kicked off that blip of a moment when Kid and Play were movie stars.
What a time to
Listen,
be alive.
Disorderlies happened. It can happen for anybody.
I had breakfast with the Fat Boys when they were promoting Disorderlies. Summer of 1987.
Okay.
Interning at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
I can't believe I'm only finding that out now.
Amazing.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking about Joe versus the Volcano as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Hey, if you like your podcast to be focused and well-researched and your podcast host to be uncharismatic, unhorny strangers who have no interest in horses, then this is not the podcast for you.
Yeah, and what's your deal? I'm Emily.
I'm Lisa.
Our show's called Baby Geniuses.
And its hosts are horny adult idiots. We discover weird Wikipedia pages every episode.
We discuss institutional misogyny.
We ask each other the dumbest questions, and our listeners won't stop sending us pictures of their butts.
We haven't asked them to stop, but they also aren't stopping.
Join us on Baby Geniuses
every other week on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi. In the studio with me today are
Drea Clark
and Joelle Monique.
Today, we're hopping back three whole decades to 1990, which I keep thinking of that song in Merrily We Roll Along, 1960, it's 1960, which was 30 years before that anyway.
How your head works.
It all keeps going backwards. So Drea, you and our listeners are responsible for the fact that we're watching this film since you guys voted for it on Twitter. You're welcome. You get to do the synopsis.
All right. So the synopsis of Joe versus the Volcano is we have Tom Hanks as Joe. He is a very bummed out man who works a very bummed out job in a sort of industrial scenario. Nothing is looking good in his life, and it's sort of routine that he's never going to get out of. He discovers, he goes to a doctor who tells him, you guys, he is dying from brain cloud.
Brain cloud!
Yes, brain cloud.
Which we're familiar with. And as a result, he only has a few months to live. So Joe says, all right, F you to this terrible job and my terrible life, and I'm going to go home. Then encounters, as one does, a crazy rich person, a crazy rich man who says, here's the thing. I need to find someone to jump into a volcano on this island so that I can do a transactional...
Mineral rights.
Yeah, get the rights for something on this island. You know, just plot stuff. And so if you say that you'll jump into this volcano, I will fund whatever you want to do for the remaining months of your life. And he's like, all right, sign me up. So he decides he's going to do that. In the course of heading there, he has a date with the woman he worked with, played by Meg Ryan in brown hair. And then he goes to Los Angeles.
Well, first he hires a limo driven by Ossie Davis.
Oh, you're right. The very best part. How dare I?
To buy a lot of 1990 clothes.
Yes.
Yes. And the best montage I've seen in a minute.
Yes. The best shopping montage you've seen in a minute.
So glorious.
Is him being guided by his driver, Ossie Davis. And so he's stocking up on all these stuff. He's doing the things you're going to do when you have all this money and not a care in the world. He goes on a date with a few different versions of Meg Ryan.
After he goes to L.A.
After he goes to L.A., he goes on the second one as he's led around town by this red-haired version of her.
Who is the guy who hired her
daughter.
Yes.
And then her half-sister plays the blonde hair, is also blonde-haired version, and that is who's going to sail him to said island. So...
three Meg Ryans.
All right. Three Meg Ryans, a Tom Hanks with money,
and
not
a
care in the world,
point?
Other than his impending death. Mm. And yeah, that's Joe versus the volcano.
That is Joe versus the volcano, yeah. Guys.
So I guess I should kick this off with a question. Drea, what the fuck?
Yes.
Well, fuck your face, first off.
Oh, it's getting violent in here.
This is a film. Actually, Alonzo knows, or might remember, that I have never seen this film until... 3 or 4 months ago, whenever I brought it up, because I had always seen the VHS copy of it, and in my head just conflated it with Bachelor Party, the other Tom Hanks. Okay. And I was like, oh, it's like one of those, I don't need to see that ever. So like 3 or 4 months ago, someone randomly said, I was like, oh yeah, I'll watch that. And was like, nobody told me Joe versus the Volcano is stone cold weird. Like that was such a revelation for me as someone who went through their whole life not knowing that there was this stone cold weird Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks vehicle out there. Like, blew my mind. And I found it so uniquely stylized. It had shades of everything from like Terry Gilliam to... not even like Tim Burton, but there was so much inventive weirdness to it. There was so much more darkness and bleakness. Like, as someone, and I do think it probably changes it to see it for the first time with, like, when I saw it with 2019 eyes of, and having the expectations of, like, decades of Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, like, cuteness. The idea of being like, what the hell? They're going to sacrifice themselves. There's elements of it that I'm like, oh, man, this is like, it's racist, but it's also sort of acknowledging the racism. What is happening? Anyway, I found this so fascinating and was like, this, as you know, I like to pick movies that we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah. Joelle, what's your Joe versus the Volcano history?
This afternoon I watched it.
Had you never seen it before?
I had never even heard of this movie.
Okay.
Listen, early Tom Hanks is very foreign to me. As I tried to explain like what my early movie knowledge was, like my father dictated all of it. So anything that could be constricted as white or corny was just thrown out. That he was like, I'm not interested in that at all. So we watched like blockbusters, all the films that like were very informal to his childhood, every sci-fi film ever, top down. So this missed me. I also did not know what to expect. I was also that office scene, very getting off the Tim Burton vibes of like, here's the weird like fluorescence and it's like very gray and like oppressive in a way that if you've ever been to a school in the 70s that didn't have windows, you like understand what this guy's life is like. All the walls are like yellowish white. It's horrifying.
You can feel the air.
Yeah. That office felt too real. I'm like, I've lived in this office and I hate it here. This movie is unhinged is the best word I could just use to describe it.
Oh, yeah.
Every time I thought it was going to go somewhere like serious or important or make a statement, it was like, is that what we're here for? It's just a complete right turn. And I feel it was so weird to watch it with 2019 eyes because
girl, you watched it with 2020 eyes.
That's also for, yes,
she's
it's 2020.
Like,
it's the year.
Years beyond me.
It is wild to remember that in the 90s you could have a movie that didn't mean anything and it could still be a success and a hit and kind of interesting. I feel like when we don't really have movies that are just like isn't trying to say anything or really be anything. This is maybe it was kind of about a guy trying to value his life, but for the most part, it was like a series of very random, disconnected events. The love story, what? I'm so confused by this movie. I need Alonzo help me.
This is a weird moment for Tom Hanks because 1990 is also the year they gave us The Bonfire of the Vanities.
It was the same year.
Yes,
he was making choices.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and this was like he got his first Oscar nomination for Big in 88. And so I think he was this like, I don't want to just be like wacky comedy The Burbs guy. I want to take on these sort of meatier roles.
I want to eventually become Tom Hanks.
I will become Tom Hanks. I had seen this movie years ago, I think probably on VHS, and had semi-fond memories of it, but hadn't looked at it in decades. And then I watched it last night, and I was not feeling it.
That's fair.
It feels like Amblin's idea of an art film. You know,
it's
kind of eccentric and kind of experimental, but not really. And we'll get like Georges Delerue to do the score, even though he's not really a right fit for this. And like Bo Welch is the production designer and Colleen Atwood does the costumes. Like they put so much money
Colleen
into this
Colleen Atwood
thing.
Did these costumes?
Oh, yes.
What was happening in these producers' minds?
So you've got John Patrick Shanley writing and directing, who had never directed a movie before.
And it was like 2 years after Moonstruck?
Yeah, Moonstruck was like 87, I think.
Okay.
And it's weird because like Shanley then like he got this and he got The January Man, which is terrible.
But then he did Doubt?
And then he did Doubt later.
No, he did another weird one in between those two. And now
what
I can't remember
it. What a wild career this man has had.
But like, so this movie to me, like, yeah, the first half hour feels like, oh, you saw Brazil. You know, like you're doing it well, and you are definitely getting that fluorescent nausea green correctly and all, you saw Brazil. And then the rest of it kind of feels like, it's almost like he's predicting Wes Anderson in a way.
But I agree with you. I think this is for sure, and I retract my fuck your face. I feel bad.
Honey, no.
I love and respect and adore you. I can't believe I said fuck your face. And you're sweet enough to rewatch this movie that you were kind of probably apprehensive about. But like, as you know, I enjoy even flawed, just like a swing for the stars.
Sure.
And this film, and I do think it was that combination of being so unexpected for me, and it is such a flavor film, and this flavor worked for me, and I can definitely see serving it to someone else who takes a bite and is like, no, I don't enjoy that taste. Because it is that thing of there's something, especially I find with films, like you say, on the path of being like proto Wes Anderson, that super heavy stylized that both wants us to have these authentic connections between the two of them, well, the third version of her, believe that there's some kind of like love story there that could happen and to care, but also the whole thing is so cuckoo absurdist.
Well, it's like you set these two up and like, you know, they have like an actual conversation. You sort of see where there's a bond forming, and then there's like a wacky fishing scene for no reason, you know?
Bizarre.
No. Amanda Plummer exists in this movie only to confuse me.
Which I loved. Carol Kane is the hairdresser.
Carol Kane. Because if you can get her, you get her.
No, it was great.
You guys also find, I definitely had a reading on this, you know, where it finished and I'm like, you know, there are at least two different points in this movie where you could easily talk me into the fact that he died then, and the rest of it is either the Jacob's Ladder, like the moment before
the brain
he dies,
cloud, yeah.
Or it's his brain cloud, right? Or like, because it's so absurdist, like, what? But yeah, I love those touches.
Why are there
touches.
Jewish Polynesians who drink orange soda?
That's
you know?
Going on.
The Jewish Polynesians I love so much because, to me, honestly, that they, I don't know if it was based on any knowledge or just trying to be weird, but like the amount of times we've seen films over the decade go to an exotic locale and not be anything but just like offensively like co-opting and just gross. This, they were like, huh, you know what? we're going to go to this island, but somehow it has been peopled entirely with this Jewish group, race of people.
And a cargo cult. You know?
It's so weird. But there are things that are threaded through that I'm like, see, that's an attention to detail that's not just brought up once. So when he's on the world's best shopping spree with Ossie mm-hmm. Davis, mm-hmm. And he's going, one of the things he spends all this time buying these gigantic
trunks
yes. like shipping trunks that you would keep all your stuff in, and they're huge. And so then, of course, you know, when a storm hits and the boat is hit by
the boat is hit by lightning that is the exact same shape as the logo of the awful yes. company where he's working at the beginning yeah. of the movie.
Yes.
What does that mean? I don't know.
I mean, like, we need to do so many drugs to get it. But what saves him is he straps together enormous trunks and then lives on them. Yeah,
best movie
pre-castaways.
Best, yeah. Exactly. Best movie luggage until the Darjeeling Limited.
Agreed.
I can't believe we haven't done a ranking of movie luggage.
I was reading on Wikipedia that this has been turned into a stage musical.
No.
And I thought, yes.
Oh, no.
Yes.
This I would watch the shit out of that.
Because I think there's so much of this that is so like playwright movie in terms of like ideas that you could do on a stage and like fake absolutely. As opposed to doing them in the recognizable world where they just seem like unbearably twee. And I could just see like that whole opening trudge into the factory. That's a musical number.
Yeah.
You know, like.
No, totally.
It is one of my favorite versions of Company Store. I'm not going to lie. I went to Spotify to try to find it. I was like, good. This is rocking.
The needle drops are working overtime in this movie. Like you are. The Ray Charles singing what's he singing during the sad part?
Yes.
Anyway, but like all the songs are like really trying to zhuzh the movie into being more than it is at that moment.
Yeah.
Like it's
they're
like
trying
calm
to
down.
Zhuzh it, but it's also again one of those things. I think there's such a weird playfulness with this movie. Like I think that the director and all of the creative team were like, oh, awesome. We are unfettered, as it were. Let's throw it all in. And I kind of enjoy that, especially for
Old Man River.
Old Man River, thank you.
Oh, yeah. No, when Masquerada plays, I'm like, okay, I like this song. I guess I like this scene now, you know.
But I like the idea that a big-ass studio movie was like, oh, yeah, how weird can we go? I'll show you. Something that I think is interesting is, and I hadn't realized these all came out in such a similar little time frame, but the weird dark comedies of Defending Your Life, Hook, Toys, you want to talk weird ass, Drop Dead Fred, and Clifford were all within 4 years of this movie.
Yeah, I that's an interesting kind of parallel. I love Defending Your Life. Like, that's a movie I still point to. Like, that and Groundhog Day, I think, are the closest I have to a philosophy in life comes from those movies, probably.
Oh, nice.
Toys, it's funny, actually, because when I think about turning that opening trudge into the factory into a musical number, the first song that pops into my mind is that Happy Workers song from Toys, which, again, I think is a movie that has a lot of problems, but like, you know, they should have just gone full bore into making it a musical because it's so hyper stylized that production design and costumes are so bonkers, you know, and you've got that amazing Wendy and Lisa song at the beginning that I love so much, the closing of the year. They might as well have just have like gone with that. And I think it would have made the movie's other excesses more forgivable, you know?
I wonder if this is the film that convinced the studio to make Castaway. Did anyone get Castaway triggers watching
100%.
This?
100%.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
That's what I was saying. When he lashes the suitcases together and he's like literally drifting, doesn't know when they're going to land, like living off of the random stuff. Yeah,
the Perrier. 100%.
And again, that's something that in our watching of seeing this for the first time, I was like, that is crazy. There's so many Castaway references.
There's a ton of times where you're like, oh, this is just Castaway. The other thing I think about a lot as we start drawing similar movie parallels from the era, a lot of the films I were watching at the time were for the youngins, like Jingle All the Way, and I think which I know is a weird film to cross parallel to this, but the idea of like men in their like maybe mid-30s fearing that they've been overworked and that they have not had any kind of substantial or significant life moments or have been too afraid to live their life really intrigued me.
Yes. the inverse of Family Man, the Nicolas Cage movie.
Exactly. We're just putting out such weird movies today, guys.
That's what happens when we retro rewind.
Because this is... I think Hank is firmly in the boomer era, yeah?
He's late boomer, I think so.
Okay, yeah.
That guy in his sneaker collection would be devastated to hear us say this.
I'm so sorry. But I'm curious as to, like, if this movie was touching that generation in such a way of, like, no, I'm gonna, like, embrace life, particularly when we look at the build of this movie, because at some point you're like, oh, he's really gonna have to jump in that volcano. How are they gonna do... I was trying to figure out, and I won't spoil it because I think that if you're going to watch a movie, that's the one part of this movie that's kind of worth it, is this, like...
They're committed to the absurdest choice
so hard.
Every bend.
I could not believe what I saw happen. I was like, that did not... I rewound it because I really did not believe that happened. And I'm like, okay, well, this is that movie. Okay.
That's, I think, the weird thing for me for this movie is that part of it feels like this is this crafted whimsy that exists under its own logic and operates under its own steam and doesn't follow the rules. And at the same time, there's something about this movie that feels so safe. You know, like this does feel like a movie that Amblin and Warner Brothers make, you know? It feels like a studio executive being like, yeah, man, this is a movie where we didn't give them notes. But that might be
the exact thing that I love about it. Like, it's the same idea as watching, like, a cozy TV show, right? Mm. I like the idea of watching something just bold and absurd and doing its own thing, but then I also am not having to watch with a deep sense of threat. This movie has a lot of, like I said, darkness to it. There's a certain nihilism to the overall perspective.
Sure.
And yet... we watch a lot of dark nihilistic stuff that gives me, I'm like, ugh, all the time. Like, I'm holding. This one did not, like, press my shoulders down. I was like, oh, I'm able to examine darkness because I'm in a weird, weird world.
I was just going to say, I think it colors inside the lines, but in interesting shades.
Definitely. Ooh. Meg Ryan, though.
Too bad they already made the poster.
Wow. Meg Ryan, if you've ever doubted her, you shouldn't have. But if you have, like, whatever she's doing as the Los Angelino is amazing. My question to you guys, did ladies, people sound like that? Or is she doing something very unique?
She is doing what a New Yorker thinks Los Angeles people are like.
Bravo.
You know, she is the walking embodiment of every New York Times article about what we do in Los Angeles.
I think another one just came out this week.
Oh, yes, yeah. It did.
Oh, no.
We hug too much, apparently.
New Yorker.
But I do appreciate that, Meg Ryan is giving it all here, and this is absolutely one of the most fun things she ever did. But, as frustrating as this movie was for me in a lot of ways, I'm glad I saw it again, and it was absolutely food for discussion.
I literally would have never, ever, ever seen this film if Drea and you lovely fans hadn't selected it, and I'm not mad that I did, because there's literally nothing before, like, I saw Big, and then nothing until... maybe Castaway was the next Tom Hanks film I saw.
Well,
like,
man, you have a Hanks
Forrest hole. Gump. There's a ton of Tom Hanks I haven't seen, so I'm glad to get in there.
It is super problematic, but I kind of like that.
Oh, it's highly problematic, guys. It's confusing.
No. Bachelor Party. Oh.
He's saying Bachelors. Well, I'll put that on my list. This Joe vs. Volcano is a screen it to me. I like that our options were screen it, watch it on basic cable, or skip it.
Well, I was going to say pay to stream it, watch it on basic cable, or skip it. But
I would pay to stream this. In fact, I did.
Oh, wow.
And it is, I would say, please see it with people, because I watched it by myself and then was like staring at my cats and being like, why won't you engage with me? There's so much to dig into.
Joelle?
I would say if you could see it on a TNT, I don't know if they screen this movie, but like, watch it with commercials, definitely watch it with some friends.
This is a very TBS.
Yes. Listen, if you happen to catch it in the middle of the day and you're at home sick with your kid or something, perfect watch, because y'all will be like, I don't know what's happening in this movie, but
I think this
wild.
Might actually work better with commercials.
Yeah. And with cough medicine.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Connie and Carla also, better with commercials. I'm also going to say watch it on basic cable, but do watch it, because it's something. We'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
What do you look for in a book? Literally, if on the bag it said, like, this book made me shit my pants, I'd be like, that's, I'm buying this book.
Yeah.
Like, I think the problem with blurbs a lot of times...
I like that we both want to crap ourselves over books.
What's the best way to e-read in the tub?
Listen to that noise. I'm reviewing a plastic bag today.
How do you find a good book?
This is the most fucked up weird shit you've ever read. Am, you're like into it. I'm like, hand it over.
Take my money.
I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara. We're Reading Glasses and we solve all your bookish problems. Every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi. In the studio with me are...
Joelle Monique.
Drea Clark.
It's time for Staff Picks, but we're keeping it theme. And we're talking about staff picks of movies from 1990 or thereabouts. Mm. You know, you can be in the vicinity. Oh. It's fine.
That tells me you're more in the vicinity.
No. I have a 1990 pick. I'm just trying to be.
Oh, you're being generous.
I'm being generous yes. to others.
I would like to say here that when we brought this up, I made a joke about Alonzo picking Gremlins 2. And he was like, I didn't. But it's a great movie.
Gremlins 2 The New Batch is fucking awesome.
Okay.
It is a Dada masterpiece and the closest anyone has ever gotten to a live action Looney Tunes cartoon. You totally need to see it.
That's right. That's why I just gave you that assist. Those words needed to be out there.
Throwing it out there. That's not even my pick yet, though. Joel, what you got?
Yeah, okay. So my original pick was going to be around the 1990s. If you haven't seen The Piano, just go see it. I'll just leave that there.
Sure.
But my pick for today, since we're going to stay in theme for the 90s, is the Rob Reiner Stephen King classic. It's Misery!
Oh, nice!
Listen, yeah. Misery is one of the first horror films I ever saw. Again, my parents had no idea what was acceptable to watch for children at all. If they were watching it, I was watching it. I did not see the most iconic, the smashing of the ankle scene, truly, until I was in high school. Here's why. It would always happen, and I would close my eyes. I described the scene to my friend like this. She picks up the hammer, and then she just smashes his ankle, and his foot is like twisting around, and it's bloody, and it's awful. And she's like, girl, I saw the movie. That doesn't happen. Like, it must have happened because this is one of my favorite movies. I've seen it happen a bunch of times. She's like, I promise you, that's not the case. So we rewatched it, and she was like, don't look away. You got to really watch it. Guys, that doesn't happen. But it is that level of psychologically scary and terrifying and awesome, and it's like a really good Stephen King movie if you're into, especially like he had this like string run of like really great, like kind of from like the 70s to the 90s of like gritty, like, psychological horror movies. I saw Pet Sematary, the original, for the first time just last year, and I was like, oh my god, geniuses were really at play today.
Also,
I love Misery.
Kathy Bates in Misery is one of the most deserved, like,
yes.
the accolades she got for that. And not just her performance, but even the casting of it. Because I swear now, if you made that role, Annie Bates.
Yeah.
The role of Annie Bates would be...
Annie Wilkes.
Annie Bates.
We got Bates
Combine
Motel.
Those two. Yeah.
There's a lot
Annie
of...
Wilkes would be the kind of role that, like, a hot actress would, like, dowdy up for.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Right?
Check yeah. my range.
You would get the... And actually casting a character actress yeah. to really sink her teeth in.
And that's pretty much, I look at that movie now and I think, oh, Twitter fandom. You saw it coming.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
Misery has prescient. Who knew?
Mm. Oh, my gosh. There's something, so I love films about obsession. I think I mentioned that last week. When people become, like, obsessed and fixated on something, they're just fun to watch. You're, like, trying to figure them out. Like, where did that stem from? And how is that impacting, like, literally every decision they're making? I am obsessed. With this woman's journey, her dedication to like making this, and then it becomes like a Get Out film where you're like, oh my god, dude, like crawl, like run, yeah. scream really loud, like what can we do, how do we get you out of here? It's thrilling from like start to finish. I adore this movie. Like, and if you haven't seen it, like please tweet me so we can like enjoy your first time experience together. I will hop
nice.
If you tweet me at the right time, I will hop on and watch it with you.
You heard it.
You have to time it just right.
And then you can follow it up with Dolores Claiborne.
Ooh. Oh, my God.
Drea, what do you got?
Okay, so I have a 1990 film
okay.
that I was obsessed with at the time. So, Joelle,
yes,
watch me.
I am.
Watch young me. and loved this film. Loved the, like, was in love with the lead actor in it to a very formative degree. This film is called Pump Up the Volume. Mr. Christian Slater was real revelatory for this gal I had the cross section of like this and gleaming the cube in Heather's. Forget it. Like, kind of like safe seeming white dude who's actually like skeezy great. However, in Pump Up the Volume, he plays my favorite kind of character, which is this dude who is awkward and shy teenager. He's just moved to a new school district for his father's work, and he is very like mild-mannered, can't talk to anybody, can't make eye contact, can't raise his hand in class. And yet at night, you guys, he runs a ham radio, like, or I don't even know if it's ham radio.
Pirate
radio station, where he plays awesome music. The whole thing is an incredible soundtrack.
It does.
And then like preaches this like Lenny Bruce, like, live your best life, they're holding you back, whatever. And of course, gains a fandom from that of like people who like start acting up at school. But it's a film that I didn't realize it so much at the time, but it's really drawing out class differences at this high school, how there are certain kids that are being pulled from school, and they, it comes out, it's because they're affecting the like overall like
the
testings,
GPA, yeah.
How the school is being judged, and there's a lot of hypocrisy in that. And but it's, so it's great and teenage and this, and you know, I love any character that's like, oh, I'm like so shy, but I have all this depth to me. Like, that's my weakness.
If you knew
as a
the
human.
Real me.
Yeah, I meet shy people, and I'm like, oh, you're probably incredible. And he's just delicious in this. Samantha Mathis plays the love interest.
Yeah.
When I first moved to LA, one of the first parties I went to, the woman who played a girl in this, who's like the rich girl who puts her pearls and all her shit
in
the
microwave,
and
yes,
it blows up, was at a barbecue I went to, and like, I've made it. Like, that was the coolest thing. Ah, oh, bless her. So anyway, Pump Up the Volume.
Good one. Written,
watch
directed,
it.
Written directed by Alan Moyle, who also did Times Square.
Yes. Alan Moyle also did Welcome to Weirdsville, which we played at Slam Dance Film Festival.
And Pump Up the Volume makes a great double feature with Over the Edge.
Oh, yeah. I'd watch those too. Yeah.
So my 1990 movie. So I think there comes a point in everyone's life, particularly if you do the kind of work we do, where you encounter art. It could be a song, it can be a painting, a film, a book, that you just, you experience it and you think, somebody gets me. Somebody has like figured out the runes of my brain, and like, we're on the same wavelength, we speak the same language, like, I'm home. 1990 gave us Sandra Bernhard's Without You, I'm Nothing.
Oh, my God.
Which to 23-year-old gay Alonzo was just like the back of my head exploding. This movie is like this incredible cabaret of like every pop culture reference that was swimming around inside of my head. And it then led me to the cast album of her stage version.
I imagine even 23-year-old Alonzo had a higher volume of pop culture references than the rest.
I think 1990 was the year I discovered Without You, I'm Nothing and Mystery Science Theater 3000. So like that was totally where my head was at. But Without You, I'm Nothing, like I then, after being obsessed with the movie, I got the cast album and like drove around listening to it all the time, knew it by heart. And what she does on stage is very much kind of a mock of sort of showbiz tropes and conventions and like fakeosity. And then she figures out a way in to do it in the movie where, like, without an audience at all, but it sort of expresses that same joke and that same kind of level of artificiality that she's operating in, but at the same time sort of like demonstrating the realness underneath. It's hard for me to explain it, but like, this is peak Sandra Bernhard. I mean, like, she's still amazing. I go see her live in LA whenever I can.
Yes.
You know, she has a show on Sirius XM. She is a goddess. She is my diva. Like, she's my Madonna. She's my Cher.
I really respect that.
Sandra Bernhard. And
if I had time travel capabilities after, obviously, I killed baby Hitler, I would enjoy coming to just to sit in the theater and be the creeper watching you. Watching this.
Sandra Bernhard brings such a unique and palpable energy whenever she's on screen. I get like
physically excited when she shows up because you know it's not going to be anything that you expect. I watched The Last King in Comedy for the first time because of Joker, and I was like, oh my God, like she's so young here. Look at her. She's precious and amazing. It's just great energy. And she had the foresight to cast Jaimin Hansu as her ex-boyfriend in the show, and like, what a revelation. Obviously smart. I've never seen this movie, but I'm going to go home and watch it.
Imagine like a movie that is almost all her at the center of the screen, often in close-up. Like
my gay heart skips a beat.
Yeah. Like, if you know, because that's the thing about Sandra. Like, you get little bits of her in movies, and she walks away with a couple scenes, and then she's gone for the rest of the film. This is her show, baby.
Ugh, awesome.
I feel good about those.
Right. We did it.
Before we go, we got to read those 5-star reviews. If you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we'll read it on the air. And modesty dictates that I pass this one to Drea.
All right. This is from Hexum311AD, who says, I followed Alonzo from What the Flick Show. Good taste. Mm-hmm. I'm politically opposite from the host of the show, yet I deeply respect their thoughts and ideas on film. On most Friday nights, I'm on my way to a movie, and I love having the show as my driving buddy. Please don't ever change and keep up the great work. Love y'all. It's from Anthony in Chicago.
Hey. Thank you, Anthony.
I love that. I really like that you are saying that you're politically opposite and then are like taking the time to listen to other people who are expressing things.
We can all get along.
Very
and talk
cool.
about Joe versus the volcano.
Yeah.
And next week, we'll be talking about The Invisible Man. Just a reminder, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. And a reminder that you can buy a Jumbotron on our show by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. Let us promote your comic book, your blog, your TikTok, your
random
your whatever
limerick that you want to get across.
It'll Love all it. We can make it all happen. MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at WhoShotYaPod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast. Or send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.